Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush, Friday interview edition here at Pond City Market, Atlanta, Georgia. And oh, boy, everybody. Hang on to your socks. Hang on to your hats. Hang on to your socks. What's the expression? Hang on to all your clothing, because we have a special two-part episode this week and next week with some of the cast of Stranger Things, one of my favorite shows, one of the favorite shows of a lot of people. And judging by the reaction I got on Facebook when I posted my pic of myself with the three dudes you're about to listen to, I think it's a favorite show of a lot of you as well. So I decided to split this up in two because it was like 2 hours long, which is great. And hey, I know all of you could sit and listen to 2 hours straight of this, but it was sort of evenly divided between about an hour of just good talking about Stranger Things, a little inside scoop there and what it's like working on that show and acting and other movies and just art and music and stuff like that. And then sort of another hour on their movie pick, which they all agreed to talk about Big Night, one of my favorite films with Tony Shalhoub and Stanley Tucci and Minnie Driver and Isabella Rossellini and Ian Holm. Such a great, great independent film from the mid-90s. So I decided to chop this one in two, and I hope you guys don't mind. I ended up having Joe Keery on and David Harbour, and that was the initial ask, and they showed up with Gelman, with Brett Gelman, and said, hey, Gelman's here. He decided to come. Is that okay? And I love Brett Gelman. I was like, oh, well, are you kidding me? This is even better. In fact, call up some other cast members and get them down here. Actually, didn't say that, but I should have. So ended up getting all three dudes in the studio, and we just had a really great conversation. So without any further ado, here we are with Stranger Things Special Part 1, Joe Keery, David Harbour, and Brett Gelman on Stranger Things.
All right. And on that note...
We are recording, but I won't, you know.
Oh, wow.
Oh, we are recording.
Yeah, but I won't release that, obviously.
Oh, please don't.
Inside Secrets with Brett Gelman. Oh,
insider trading.
Should we record the whole thing?
I don't know when you hit record, but I don't, this isn't a gotcha type of thing.
DMZ.
You don't have to worry
DMZ,
about that.
What Brett really thinks about something you have no idea
exactly,
about.
Exactly, and no one else cares about.
Together.
Finally, uncovered.
Is Brett Gelman's life provocatively interesting?
Oh, I sort of wish people cared what you thought about these, like, random people. Make it a world.
It would mean
a
I was more
place.
Successful.
It would just make the world a better place.
Right. If they were following my moral lead on who's a good person and who's
I
not
take that
and
back.
What you should
yeah,
do.
Yeah, I take it back.
You make... think I'm an immoral person?
No, I just don't think that it would make the world a better place. No,
it might make it a little
back
bit
my
better.
My statement. I think you're very moral.
How do you know,
You're actually
though...
super – you're a lot more sensitive than I imagined.
Anticipated. Like, I agree.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I'm always confused that you – have feelings.
So when you say he's more sensitive, he's slightly sensitive, and you thought he was a monster.
No. I actually think he's just very caring, like a very caring, emotional dude. But when I see your comedy and
like
stuff, it seems to come from like
rage.
Know, this place of not. No, this place of like not caring what people think of you.
Maybe
like
condescension,
not caring, which I like. It's a brave place
and
right,
funny.
But I wouldn't think. Yeah. But I wouldn't think that you'd have that depth of like sort of insecurity or like, oh, did you mean that? Or well, like those conversations that we have occasionally, which are like,
right.
Oh, I didn't mean that. And it's, you know, it's very refreshing. It's a very three-dimensional.
Yeah. And sometimes not knowing if you're joking, I think, is kind of what it boils down to.
Yeah. Do you find my comedy two-dimensional?
Your comedy two-dimensional?
Yeah.
That's interesting. I don't find it two-dimensional, but I do think it's the most interesting when you bring in that
the vulnerability,
other aspect, which you did, I feel like, last night as well, a little bit even.
Right.
Even with like little lines like that. We did this show last night at Dad's Garage.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And Brett
that's cool.
got up with the improvers and did some great stuff. And one of the moments
nice.
I really liked was like, it was just a little thing, but like, you're with this girl and she's like, so we've been together for a while. And you're like, yeah. And she's like, I'm happy. And you're like, yeah, I'm happy too. Otherwise, I would break up with
you. Yeah.
She's like, do you want to break up
blatantly
with me?
Honest.
And you're like, no. I mean, I'm happy.
Yeah.
Well, I was nervous because you guys, when you were in the bathroom, I told Brett, I'm a big fan. I was like, I think you're one of the great weirdos in comedy. But to me, that's like the highest compliment. And I mean that in that
I thought you
said I was one of the great heroes of comedy. Oh, weirdos.
Exactly.
Wait a second.
What the fuck is your problem, asshole? No.
Sorry. I'm one of the great weirdos of drama.
Yeah, no, I am. The choices. I do take that as a compliment.
Yeah, like the choices that you make are always just fucking heavy on the floor.
And, I am strange, yeah. I guess.
We're all strange. Who isn't strange? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like anytime you think about your own family, I think you immediately realize that there's no such thing as normal. Right.
And
when you think about like the world, you think like normal. But then when you think about anyone close to you, you're like, we're all strange, right?
No, totally. Yeah. But that is something that I want to bring more into all of my
Interesting.
Work.
So you have is thought vulnerable. About this.
Oh, of course. No, I think that there was a time where I was obsessively confrontational.
Yeah.
And
your work? That is kind of a theme, I would say, probably.
And
in
I
some
feel
of your stuff.
That, you know, now and I've been, you know, really trying to show that in my acting work and the characters I play in showing the other side
Spoiler alert,
of that confrontation.
Season 3 Stranger Things.
Do you think do you think it's hard because people kind of
I was told
Murray
I couldn't talk about season 3.
Extremely sensitive. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no,
do people kind of think when you get cast, like put you in a box in terms of like you get sent
always,
in for
well,
the
we
confrontation
were talking about
guy?
Last night,
you know?
People love to have me scream.
Yeah.
But I want it to be seen as more of a Gene Wilder scream and less of a Sam Kennison, I guess, scream. Not that I was ever Sam Kennison, but like
– Gene Wilder's are great.
Yeah.
Yeah, just – but you know what – I don't – you know, what you know, I mean when you're screaming, it's just what's happening in the moment. You're not like saying like, oh, this would be a great part for my classic scream.
I mean this is a cliche thing to say, but I do feel like in general – people put us in boxes in various ways, right? And then whenever you're allowed to play the opposite of that or outside of that, in general, I'm much better. You know what I mean?
Like
it allows you to explore these colors or it forces you to like, you know, have to be more. And I always think those are my better performances.
I think that Murray is very much outside of a box for me in a pretty profound way.
In which way?
Well,
I think
we can't.
That
hold on.
I guess.
No, I mean in season two.
Okay.
In season two, I thought because he's
like
not.
Like he's like needy, you mean?
He's not. He's doing the right thing. He doesn't resort to making a massive mistake ever. You know, he has a strange way of communicating, and that is a common theme amongst a lot of the roles I play. But he is going towards success rather than failure. And but then like in Lemon, I think there was that was like the culmination of that type of role for me because there was an insane amount of vulnerability and sadness in that in a way that I wasn't able to do in other characters.
Yeah. You had a lot more room in Lemon too. Like you're not given that kind of space in a lot of the stuff you do.
Right.
Where you have the whole movie. And you have to show this arc.
That's such a luxury. That's so nice to be able to just like have a.
What is this? Are we doing a podcast? What's that?
Yeah, sorry. Just
no. This is the podcast. It's exactly what we do, and I've had had the Broken Lizard guys in here, so I've managed to wrangle six of them.
Okay.
So I think that this is going great so far.
All right. Just want to make sure.
But I think, I think in a lot of like in Fleabag and Love, I think in a lot of my roles, I've been able to have that vulnerability, even if audience members sometimes don't see it because they're just seeing the actions of the character, but not the.
Yeah. I think it's like a success, I think, to like, you know, when people do want to cast you or typecast you in a part to be able to like give them that flavor, but then also have that little, you know, two or three moments where they see the little. And I think that's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Being able to have just that little, these moments of like, oh, that guy can also do that. Like using the thing to be able to show that you can also.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
I'm lucky
I get to do that.
The majority of my film work, I was like the bad guy, the psychotic guy.
Is that what your like typecast is?
Guy. Yeah, I was the villain. I mean, I was the villain based on like either, you know, insecurities or you know, psychosis or whatever it was, but like Hollywood viewed me as like a dude you don't root for. Like,
that is so funny.
A bad guy.
Yeah.
And I think that part of the fun thing was like, you know, like I even played this like super crazy serial killer in
this Liam Neeson movie, Walk Among the Tombstones. And, you know, part of the fun of that would be to infuse these guys with some sort of point of view that didn't seem completely psychotic, like to infuse them with some humanity.
Something you
right?
can kind of like understand.
So. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or, you know, they just lived a certain life that was freedom. But I think Stranger, like the great thing about a psychotic is they actually do exactly what they want to do.
Yeah.
Which we don't really do in our lives.
Right. Right? Because you're trying to please people.
And well, or even just the fact that you associate yourself as like a son or mm-hmm. a father or a boyfriend. And so you don't just, you know, say exactly what's on your mind at any given moment. But psychotics actually do that.
Right.
And children do it too. Which is why you have to tell children.
There's like no social boundaries.
Well, you have to tell children yeah. when they're 5 years old that you can't say, why are you so fat or something? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You have to tell them, like, that's not a nice thing to say.
Like
you
filter, have to pretty much. Them. They have no
yeah.
filter.
And the interesting thing about the transition from bad guy to, like, hero was that it went through, like, a childish phase. So the freedom of, like, Copper is a bit of a child in the first season especially. Like, he lives a child's life. He has no responsibilities.
Yeah, I mean, you were always the shirt untucked sheriff. You yeah. know, you weren't squared away.
First scene is, like, pretty – it's exactly what it is.
Yeah, and he has no responsibilities, and he doesn't give a shit about anybody. So there is a freedom in that, and then you start to realize that he has this heart and this sort of thing underneath it. But it's an interesting thing when people put you in these boxes. I feel like, and then like I think you're stepping into a boxed area
for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's see,
career wise or
yeah,
on the show?
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand. I understand it because like from the outside, when you're watching somebody do something, of mm-hmm. course, if you're you know involved in a project and you are trying to think, like, who could play this? You think of other people who are playing similar roles. So
right.
obviously the things they're going to send you
yeah.
are going to be – you know, I think that that's kind of where your – I guess, like, your own personal taste, of course, but maybe, like, your team as well, like working and pushing you towards
right.
and understanding what too. Else – understanding
yeah,
what
always.
Else you can do. So, like, having people advocating for you that, like – know that you can do something different and push you in different ways is kind of like...
How much is that as far as working with management teams is like, no, I want to do this type of stuff even if I don't work for the next year and them going like, well, you'd really rather you just work.
I mean, I don't think that there are those arch conversations that you see in movies or you think of the cliche in your mind.
Right.
Like, I've never had that arch conversation where it's like... You know, I on my side, I'm like, I want to do a play. And they're like, no, like, you have to do movies to make money or something, to do this commercial.
Yeah.
But I do think that there's just a subtle thing where, you know, I think everybody wants to be successful
yeah.
at what they do. So even the idea that I would want to explore something different would be a risk for me. And so I may be looking for reinforcement from the team to go like, this is great. Like, this is close or this is blah, blah, blah. And I think that everybody tries to – because at the end of the day, it's like it's a business or it's like, you know, you're making a widget. Like, on a macro level, like, entertainment is a business. So if you're a really good cog at a really good thing,
right.
the business is like, you're really good at this cog thing. Like, why are we – fixing it.
Yeah,
all making millions of dollars yeah. doing this cog thing. Like, don't, you know.
It's almost like a writer being like, man, I would really love to try, you know, doing this and then being like, well, you're a really good writer. Maybe you should just stick in that lane
yeah, exactly.
sort of, you know.
Yeah, I mean, your agents yeah. and your reps' job is to get you a job.
Right.
So they're going to try and do that in the most surefire way possible, and then it's up to you. They're not going to see you as something that you see yourself when they have not really seen evidence of that.
Right.
So you have to.
I mean,
and
I myself suffer from those insecurities as well, though. Like, I don't know that I have
could
the
do
bravery
something.
To stand up to a group of people and be like, I want to do this. You know, because I like the attention, I like the support of people to say like, no, this is great and this is great for you and blah, blah, blah. Like, I don't know that I've had those. I mean, have you had like big rep conversations where you're
like disagreements you're
yeah,
saying?
I mean, I have, of course. And I've actually fired reps and like left things and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But in general, I think it's much more of a holistic thing that like the fears and the support are all moving towards a certain thing, which is like, you know, a more of a niche thing. And it really requires a lot of energy to stop and go, you know what, like, no.
Well, for me it was I trained as an actor and then I found myself in New York and I got caught in the alternative comedy scene, the improv sketch comedy scene at UCB, at the Upright Citizens Brigade, and then with Adult Swim. And then you know, in the whole alt comedy community. And so that's what I started to be seen as part of that community, because I was. But then, you know, once I got reps and I started going out on auditions, I was like, well, I actually am
a trained actor.
I want to do more complex roles. And not that I want to stop doing this, but in addition, I want to do, you know, more complex things, you know, that hit dramatic tones or, you know, other genres. So, like, so that was, yeah, there was some leaving of reps who couldn't, you know,
understand.
Wrap their mind around that. And I think that the people I'm with now, when I started the new relationship with them, I was like, this is why I left and this is what I need now. And
right.
So there was that conversation. But then it's still like – it's still always like a slog.
It's kind of job. It kind of forces you to kind of like understand a little bit more of what you want though as well, I think, when you're kind of going through that process.
Yeah. And then like luck too of like, whoa, okay.
I mean, for me, I guess I keep coming back to this thing though, the fear though too of like giving up. Like I get confronted with that, right? Like I'm going into this thing now, like John Levinsky and I have written this very comedic sort of thing that we're going to do. And it's like a total departure from like what I do. And I think in that way.
Just broad comedy?
Yeah, it's kind of Python-esque.
Oh, wow.
Like, you know what I mean? It's the conceit is kind of like these plays that they used to film.
Mm-hmm.
And this very narcissistic Orson Welles type figure who is spearheading this effort to do these ridiculous plays on film.
Is that you?
Yeah. So
is it like mockumentary style? Like almost like
it's, you know, we don't want to do it like that Chris Guest sort of thing, but it's more true. But there is now pieces throughout it where I am talking to camera. It's still in development, but I am talking
it's
to
like
camera just because it's too fun.
It's like quirky.
I mean,
I'm absolutely terrified because, like, there's a certain thing where it's like when you start to branch off in those ways, you really can be bad. You know, you could really fall on your face and be like, okay.
But
like,
I think
I'm
that you are naturally funny.
I agree.
I do think that you're naturally funny.
Guys.
I do think that you're really. I mean, I think a lot of times you're really funny in the show.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And,
for sure.
And you know comedy, and you'll commit, and you also are raised in the theater.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
theatricality.
It seems like the pieces are all.
It's really just
there.
A character and the tone of the piece, which you are fully.
But I
fully
do have those
in, so
moments
like
where. I guess. But I do have those moments where I'm just like, oh man, you got this sort of thing. Like, just do the thing. Like, people are offering you things where you just be the, like, you know, detective. It's kind of dramatic or whatever.
Right.
And then to actually, like, take this risk where you could be really bad is like, why am I doing this again? Like, oh yeah, because I need to. And I think that's the thing. I mean, it does come to that. But I do find that it requires a lot more energy than when I didn't have Stranger Things. It
sure.
required a lot less energy. So I think the fact that the show is so beloved
mm-hmm.
has a dual thing where it, like, it's really great and
yeah.
offers a lot of opportunities. And also I find myself boxing myself in going like, you know, I don't know that I need, you know, whereas before when I wasn't really known as well, I could make more of a fool of myself. And now find that my own head plays tricks on me.
There's more at stake now for sure.
Yeah, that my head plays tricks on me. Like, well, do you really want to risk that? Like,
right.
But,
man.
You know, the problem is you become a bit, not to say he hasn't done this. I mean, I think that, like, he's made attempts at this, but you become a bit like, you know, I say like Tom Cruise in terms of your approach where you're just like, I have to play the hero or
mm-hmm.
my character always has to be smarter, faster, better. And, you know, he can be in hard situations.
Right.
He can have particular character traits, but he has to appear in a certain way on film. And that's like a weird mentality for an artist, and that to me is the real balance between artist and commercialism. It's not so much the managers against you. It's more you and the managers against you and the managers. Like, I think
mm-hmm.
the team is always with you in a certain way. But I think it really is this struggle about, like, the business as opposed to you being an artist, like, going forward and trying to explore things.
Yeah. What about the Duffers? Were those guys Did they give you a lot of leeway in finding your character, or were they had pretty specific things in mind?
We were just talking about this. Yeah.
Yeah, the first season, it was like, I think I got one note the entire season.
Yeah.
So, and I was doing crazy stuff. Like, there's stuff, there's like little scenes in there that were written in a certain way. That, like, there's one scene where I come out of the house and Jonathan follows me out and is like, I want to come with you. And I'm like, no, you stay here with your mom. Like, she needs you. And I just get in the car and I remember them thinking, and I do the scene and I come out. And Jonathan was like, I want to come with you. And I just hit him, like, in the shoulder. I'm like, stay with your mom.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and I just think that they were like, oh, we thought it was kind of a sweet scene. Where like, mm-hmm. But, like, you did this thing. And I was like, yeah, I think he's a hard guy. He just got talked about his dead daughter. Like, I think he, like, thinks men should be men. And mm-hmm. not, like, you know, he's an 80s man. He's like, little boys shouldn't cry. Like, that was one of the things that my grandma said to me, Southern woman. Back in the day when I cried when I was 5 years old or something, she was like, boys don't cry, boys don't cry. And there's something about that that, of course, now we have tremendous judgment about. But back then, I sort of liked that. I just liked mm-hmm. honoring that. And so there were all these little things which they were confused by. And I think they're so good at hiring people who do things better than they do in certain ways
mm-hmm.
and allowing those people to do those things as opposed to feeling like they have to have ownership over everything. I think that's because they're so good at what they do,
right,
that they don't feel the need to have to get into everybody else's business.
Yeah, that's
and
great.
I think they also know they can edit it if they need to.
Like, I mean, yeah, right. That's, yeah, also.
But, yeah, you had the same experience in season one,
yeah,
too,
I mean,
right?
They kind of
the entire
like
character change is resolved.
Yeah, they just kind of provide this sort of skeleton and stuff, and then you're able to kind of fill it in with your own. Right? And also just justify everything in your own way. I think that's the most important thing that they allow you to do is just, like, make sense of it in your own way and not necessarily – I mean, the perfect example is what you were just talking about. Like, they saw the scene a certain way. You saw the scene a different way.
Yeah.
And you did it, and they're like, oh, that's actually really good and makes sense. So and I think that also allows all the people who are doing it, like the actors, to be way more invested because it's their own ideas.
Right.
And they have their own, you know, skin in the game sort
of. Yeah. And you had one of the coolest success stories in that you were written in so much more heavily in season two because I think – everyone loved your character, and it was kind of clear what was going on. So as an actor, that's got to be awesome to go in there for sort of a smallish part and, like, work your way into the lineup.
Oh, it was, you know, talk about luck. I mean, the first season is just, you know, so much based on luck, and then kind of as it was going along, feeling like
well, and you
more
being
and more
great,
involved.
You know.
Yeah, but it's also just like, yeah, it's just kind of very exciting and, you know, it's also just like my first job, really. I haven't really had another job besides this. So it's, you know, it's also so interesting to hear about.
So annoying.
They're all like,
oh,
this,
like,
they
talk like that.
But I know, but I also feel like so envious of having other experiences outside of the show, you know, that kind of give you some perspective because then for me, I think
true.
It's different. Like,
you don't know how to be grateful for this.
No. I don't know how to be grateful. And I feel like in some ways I'm in sort of a different box than you guys because, you know, you've been around and you've worked with other people and been seen in other things. And for me, it feels like a little bit more like because the Duffers have constructed, you know, allowed me to be sort of – have written it for me a little bit. I think it is slightly harder for me in some ways to get myself – to motivate myself out of the box and really try to, you know, motivate myself into like a different sort of lens. You know
what
I mean?
That's interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think early success is problematic, too. I mean, Tennessee Williams, like, everybody, you know, warns against it. So,
yeah.
But, yeah, but you seem,
but
like,
I mean,
you
very, very
you seem like you're doing all
I mean,
right.
I'm very grateful that I'm still really not that successful.
But you are getting, talk about coming into the lineup. Like, the funny thing is you said that about Joe, and now we got Gelman over here forcing his way into our party as well through his talent.
Well, like, what was that like for you coming in on a season with, like, I know how film crews are, and it's like summer camp and family, and it's like walking in on an established.
Because you came in the first day with me, right?
It
was just the two of us.
Yeah.
But like right off the bat, I just want to hear your experience, actually. I don't want to tell you.
Well, I mean, first of all, it really was a dream job. Mm-hmm. It was a job I really wanted to get. Before,
so did you watch season one?
Yeah, I watched it in like a day. I loved the show.
Yeah.
So I immediately called my reps and I was like, you know, if there's anything in season two, I'd really, you know, really like to get on this show. And
that's so cool.
They got me an audition for this character and I went in and like, I saw this another actor I knew like in the waiting room, and he was like acting all kooky in the chair.
Oh no!
I was like, oh great! Oh fuck! He's so fucking methoded out right now. He's gonna get it.
It's so funny because I couldn't imagine anybody else.
I couldn't either.
Anybody else in the role besides you, actually. Yeah.
Thank you very much. No, so but then I got it, which blew my mind. And then when I got to set, the first interaction was with David. And David was so welcoming and excited for me to be there. So – and I was a fan of David's too from all of his – you know, work over the years and including the show.
Yeah.
He was always an actor I very much admired. So it felt good that my first scene partner was like so there.
Right.
And then the Duffers were so welcoming.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, it made me, I'm pretty good at inserting myself in situations. I'm a pretty loud person.
Well, coming from where you came from, you kind of have to do that a little bit.
Yeah, you have to know how to enter.
Yep.
So I'm pretty good at that. But that being said, it doesn't matter how much I know how to enter if people don't want me to enter.
Right.
So I felt very supported.
That's great.
And that really helped. And then working – and the same thing went with Charlie and Natalia in our scenes together. They were so sweet. And then by that time, you know, it helps to be funny and that gets the crew on your side.
Yeah, then you've ingratiated yourself.
I think there's always a thing with the crew that they're wondering, well, which actor are you? Are you the actor who acknowledges that we're part of this too? Or are you the actor that thinks it's all about you?
It comes in and steps over everybody.
And I think that, part of our job when we get to a new job, but throughout the job, is to be like, this is an ensemble effort. And part of the ensemble is the crew.
Man, I think that is so, so important.
I think part of it. Like the funny thing is when I think about the acclaim and the money and the attention that we get, as opposed to like first team PA who has to be there every day at 5 a.m. Setting up the trailers and leaves the last at night. Like, you know, there are so many people that work so much harder than we do. Not to say I don't work very hard outside and have lots of homework and lots of things to do, but I
– day to day,
There are so many people that work so hard to make that show that it is – at a certain point, it does get kind of silly.
And you feel – I always feel like, man, it's like I'm just like the teeniest little bit of the tip of this massive amount of work was done underneath. And it's like people who will come up and be like, oh, my God, I love the show. It's like – it's like I wish that whole adoration could be spread throughout these people who are actually.
You know, I was up for an Emmy this year.
And last year. Was it your third year or second?
Second.
Second, of course.
I did think that like I was like, and I said this online, I actually really wanted to do this if I won. I didn't win, so it didn't matter. But I wanted to melt it down, like melt down the Emmy and just make like little pins for people.
Oh, man.
And just be
cool
like
ideas.
To give it out to every person really on the crew. But apparently, this is hilarious and interesting. If you win an award, which I don't remember this because we won a SAG award, but right when you get off stage, they make you sign something. And you're not going to read it. You're so excited.
Is it like we won't – you can't like abuse.
You can't alter your statue?
You can't alter it. You can't touch it. You can't sell it.
Wow.
You can't do anything with it or they'll like sue you. Yeah. Wow. So it was like they're really touchy about you messing
with
the award. So yeah,
I'm glad. I don't want you to ever melt it down anyway, even if that was the thing.
Really? Because I think they're so – like the funny thing about
awards – you don't want your brooch?
I have a couple silly ones. Like we have an MTV movie award one now. But they're so funny. Like they sit there like wherever in your house and they become so like non-entity anyway. Like I'd wear a tin.
It's also kind of like you want to hide it. You want to – I don't ever
– Oh, really?
The one that we got from the SAG. Me and Charlie's –
You have that modesty about it?
Like, me and Charlie's are both still in the attic of the place that he used to live. It's too heavy to fly with. It's like you can't take it home.
It feels to me as an outsider like those awards are about that night.
Yeah.
And then your legacy when you die because you are now
right
Emmy Award winner – And then everything in between, it's like it's on the shelf or whatever.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Like that night is very, very special.
I'm sure, it's great.
And then when you have a movie come out, I guess they're like Golden Globe winner Claire Foy or something. You know what I mean? And you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, it's like saying Sir Ian McKellen.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
You have like a title. Exactly. Or...
And then when you die, it'll be great in your obituary.
I mean, I've won some Webbies, guys. So
I won a Webby.
Heck yeah.
I won the spring one.
Uh-huh. Yeah, they're sitting out there.
Damn.
It's fantastic. Yeah. Pretty
intense.
I would masturbate to my awards.
Really?
To them or on them or...
them?
Okay. Them, though.
Including them.
No, they stay clean and polished.
Yeah, they... High.
Come free.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Sorry.
This really took a turn. It was a PG broadcast until that.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
This was on PBS until a moment
full
ago.
Deadpool.
Yeah. It's like, no, it's come free, guys. That's good.
Yeah, it's a good...
Yeah, that is PG.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about...
Cum-filled.
Cum-filled awards. No, I'm... no, I mean, I... Yeah. If that ever happens, what will that be like? I don't know. I've never been in that situation, so...
I will say, like, I don't... You know, the whole thing is like, oh, nomination, blah, blah, blah. And it is. Like, it's, you know, whatever. I love the nomination. I like... But when you win, it's like you don't – and you don't care when you're nominated. You're like, oh, it doesn't matter. It's all random who wins. And then you win one and you're like, wow. Oh, it feels really nice to go out the back door. Like when we won that SAG award, man, like that was like – that felt like super fun. And like you go out the back and like they give you the thing and like at the parties afterwards, you know.
Yeah.
You're holding it and it's really – it's a nice night. Yeah, it's a very nice night.
It's so hard. It's so hard. It's like also –
because we've lost so many.
Yeah,
like we've been to the Emmys twice and not won a single one. We were nominated in tons of categories and not won a single Emmy. So those nights are always like – especially when they start racking up. Like when you lose one and then you lose the next one, you lose the next one, and then it's up to like best show. And you're like, there's just no way. There's just no way.
It so all feels so like – but it also feels like – I guess it feels – you know, kind of like it's also objective at the end of the day.
Yeah. Subjective.
Subjective.
Yeah, it's
so it's like
random.
Just based
it's
on people's
random.
Kind of opinion about
yeah,
it.
What
so
they
it's like
yeah.
what Apples I think necessarily yeah, I agree, is yeah, yeah. great is no. so it although you know it does mean a bunch, and I think I would in this situation I would be you know obviously honored.
Yeah.
But I think it's also kind of like at the end of the day, it is just. You know, so based on
right.
rich people's opinions. So
was
it's
that,
kind of like
Dustin Hoffman speech. Not, remember, have you ever seen that?
No,
I don't know.
Have you ever seen that speech where he like he won Best Actor
for Rain Man?
I think
probably?
It was Kramer versus Kramer.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
And he was just like, you know, this is ridiculous to say that I'm a better actor than my fellow nominees Jack Lemmon or Al Pacino.
Yeah.
It's like
it's not like a sport where it's like you got more points.
It's also like how. That seems like really good cocaine, Dustin. If I was an adult during that time and using cocaine, I would ask you for whoever's number that was who gave that to you. Right, it was just like, whoa. And then, like, Sinatra comes out and, like, to, like Mr. Hoffman has any problem with the Oscars.
No way, really? Oh, I got to watch this whole interaction.
Oh, man.
Sinatra went at Hoffman.
I mean, my
and then,
only...
then the cocaine takes a different turn. You're paranoid that the mob is going to kill you. Yeah.
Well, they used to do crazy stuff back then. Like Brando sent out his Native American spokesperson.
I know.
That was
sort
cool.
Of refuse the
that was
cool.
Kind of great.
That was like that was. I thought that was cool because that was like a political statement that was just like something that was way before Hollywood was even in any way or America was in any way thinking about that.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty badass.
Well, you had some – Hollywood's always been – you know, there was the blacklist. I mean, Hollywood's always been political in many ways. And didn't you have like – wasn't Hanoi Jane before that? I mean, wasn't Jane Fonda sort of ousted?
Have you guys seen that documentary yet?
No.
The
no.
HBO one?
Is it good?
Oh, man, it's so good.
I bet. She's amazing.
She is. And even if you know she's amazing, you see this documentary.
I bet.
Just like, man, what a badass.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Like she fully gets on at the end and is talking about her plastic surgery and saying, I wish I would have been braver to have not felt like I needed to do this. And just like that takes a lot of balls to say something like that. You know, when you're a legend like that, to sort of admit that I wish I hadn't have done this and I felt like I sent the wrong message.
Yeah.
You know? And the whole Hanoi Jane thing, man, I just, it's
she's
sad.
She's so sexy. I did a
people still hate her for that.
Of, I was in newsroom and I remember one of the first table reads, she sat next to me and I was like, I was like, hi, Jane, I'm David. She was like, hello.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God. Oh my God, I'm feeling all sorts of things.
She enjoys that feeling.
I know. Yeah. She's and what, she's 70? How old is she?
She's in her 70s for sure.
Yeah, she's amazing. Yeah. I mean, and also, I think the single greatest performance, this is not the movie we're going to talk about if we ever talk about a movie, but the single greatest performance, man or woman, on film, I think.
Whoa.
Is her performance in Clute.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I actually think that that performance is so. Like the dangers, the pitfalls in that performance of her making her a hooker with a heart of gold is so easy. Like other actors would take that and like sentimentalize it.
Mm-hmm.
And she makes her so hard. And also someone who you can't figure out. She makes her such an enigma and so hard.
Yeah.
And like that is what a prostitute is. Like they're just so hard. They don't have this like beating heart of gold, and it's so brave. That performance is so brave. Like, it is a total. I think it's the greatest film performance of all time.
Wow,
there you go. I've said it. Jane Fonda.
End of interview.
Not, and Barbarella is number two.
You think it's better than God? I wish I could.
Brett, what do you think is the
terrible
best?
Right now? terrible performance right now. What do I think is the best performance on film of all time?
Wow. Christ.
David sort of set the standard.
None of these are going to be the film we talk about, but go ahead.
I would say that it's a tie for me, my own personal favorite, between Zero Mass Dell and Gene Wilder and The Producers.
Okay.
Those are my two
Both
favorites.
Both solid.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah, okay. I think as an actor, if you look at those performances, those two performances, I am going back and forth between the two a lot of the time.
Damn.
Influentially.
That two shot at the beginning of the movie, just that wide shot of like, mm-hmm. It's like a 7 or 8 minute shot, right?
Yeah.
Of just the two of them talking in that room.
Yeah, it's incredible.
It's insane.
Yeah, so that's my favorite. But I mean, I don't know. There's just perform, and then there's performances too that you see as a child. And like, I think of my favorite actors, and it's all that influenced me the most as a kid. And most of those people are like white guys.
Yeah.
But then you get older and you get more sophisticated, you know.
Sure.
Or hopefully you do. And, you know, you see different types of performances that influence you along the way. So I think it's always like important to continue to be influenced by great performances as well. But like, you know, you look at like Geraldine Page, we were talking about Interiors.
God. Oh
it's
my
like,
God.
It's like you're seeing a person.
I don't know that movie.
You don't know this movie?
No.
It's a very dark Woody Allen movie.
Yeah, like, it's probably his most serious movie.
He was heavily influenced by like Bergman and stuff. So it was like.
It's a dramatic parody of Bergman.
Is it supposed to be a parody?
Yeah.
No, not a parody, but it's like his Bergman
movie,
it's also him. It's like a really
– right.
It's why, you know,
but it's,
despite everything.
But it's Geraldine Page, who is one of the greatest like actresses of all time. Again, maybe – what was Geraldine Page in
– Trip to Bountiful, she got the Oscar for.
Yeah, but you wouldn't know. What was she in – oh, she's in that Gene Hackman – is she in the Marvin Gardens or
King of Marvin Gardens?
King of Marvin Gardens.
Is she in that?
No. It's something with.
She's in the original Beguiled.
Yeah.
The Clint Eastwood.
I don't know. I can't think of anything like super popular like that she's been in. But she, you know, I mean, big stage actress, big. She's just like, she's incredible. And this performance in Interiors is like stunning. Stunning.
It's watching a person who it's like, you don't see the line at all.
Yeah, exactly.
Hmm. Yeah.
Joe Keery.
Dude, man.
Joe Keery, best performance. Favorite performance.
Man, I don't know.
One of them.
I guess maybe thinking about just like actors, maybe like John Cazale, maybe?
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Probably.
Totally.
Would be, I don't know. Short career.
Said that he learned to act from
John Cazale.
Dog Day. Yeah,
but
afternoon.
Yeah, Dog Day.
But it's like, isn't it only like four movies? It's like Dog Day, Afternoon,
and they all won Best Picture.
Yeah, it's
yeah. I think that that guy is like
Dog Day won Best Picture.
Yeah. Apparently, all five John Cazale films have won Best Picture.
Really?
So we should fact check.
Google that.
But I heard that he was in five movies. They all won Best Picture.
I think so it's like four.
Godfather 1, Godfather 2, Deer Hunter, Dog Day, and no idea.
Can't remember the other one.
The Pink Panther reboot.
Yeah. His best ghost. Performance, Tobey Maguire, Spider-Man 3. No, I don't know. That's a guy, though, that I feel like is like maybe not necessarily the shining star. I mean, although he's so strong in all of his movies, he's such like an ensemble man and just always delivers such a great, you know, convincing, really convincing, incredible. You know, world building. He's such like a generous guy to all these other actors that like I feel like that – is like such a great thing to sort of
well,
aim
and to play Fredo, it's just like, all right, there's three brothers, and you're the worst one.
And that character could have gone such a different way, you know what I mean? To give him such like a heart and like, you know, you're really feeling for that scene
so
where he's
empathy
on the,
for him.
When he's on the couch, you know what I mean? That scene is just...
Yeah, you always got the feeling that he was doing the best he could do.
Wilder in Blazing Saddles is insane performance because
this is my dad.
Wilder performance. He's in Willy Wonka.
Yeah. Like, come on.
In Blazing Saddles, though, it's different than all the other movies because he manages to be in a different movie and the same movie at the same time. He's playing the drama of that character through most of it and like not really in a movie where everybody else is very much playing the comedy to a genius level.
Yeah.
I mean, Madeline Kahn.
You know what's funny? Talk about not judging the character for that. Like, that is like, such a serious – he is just fully –
You know what's funny to me is the way these actors have transitioned in my mind. Like, I started out with Gene Wilder when I was like – 7, 8, 9, 10 in those bad him and Richard Pryor movies.
Yeah.
Like, do you remember those movies
but some of them are good.
A couple of them are all right.
Stir Crazy and Sober Crazy's Stir Crazy are great.
Yeah.
Those are great movies.
And like, See No Evil, Hear No Evil.
Yeah.
That one was a little...
I remember The Woman in Red was one I watched on HBO a lot.
Oh, yeah,
as
I did
a kid.
Too. Yeah. That's not and a good
back,
movie, but
well, it's
he's
not
great.
Bad, though. He and Grodin have some pretty...
Oh, yeah.
Grodin classic lines.
That's another one that's who doesn't get... That's another John Cazale who doesn't get the credit.
Yeah, I mean, I could do a whole, like,
actor he is.
Podcast about Midnight Run.
Yeah.
Like a 10-part series on Midnight Run.
We just rewatched it.
We've been obsessed with it lately. We send each other scenes,
like, from it.
Those are two of the best
Why are you so unpopular with the Chicago Police Department? Why are you so unpopular with the Chicago Police Department?
I guess you do a dramatic reading.
Don't get me started, man.
And that's actually the movie I read. That's actually the movie that made, I read about this, that made De Niro a movie star.
Really?
He was considered like this, you know, the best actor.
Uh-huh.
But
studios didn't want to.
Studios didn't see him as a box office draw.
Right, because Raging Bull and Taxi Driver, those weren't huge
Scorsese,
box office.
This is the thing you have to remember about Raging Bull is that Scorsese, after he made that movie, would go into Hollywood parties and people would turn their backs on him.
No,
according to Easy Rider's Raging Bull, telling the truth. That's what, you know. And I think Scorsese has said that in interviews because that performance is, you know, I know it's cliche to say that, but that performance is completely insane.
Which one?
De Niro and Raging Bull.
But Midnight Run is what made him.
In Taxi Driver, it's like a complete shamanistic transformation and entering into another person.
Oh, jeez, I feel like that's a, you know, crazy. I don't know if you...
I love those stories of him and Jodie Foster. You heard those stories that she tells about that?
No.
She was like, really like
was
10 or 11. Oh, was
at
she?
The time. I think she was 15.
Okay.
But he would really want to, like, he just wanted to work before they started shooting. And so he would be like... Can we go have lunch? And they would go to a diner, and he would just sit there with her, and she would order and whatever, and like, and he wouldn't eat, and he would just sit there with her, and he wouldn't talk.
Yeah.
And like, they did this for like a month, where they would just get together at this diner, and then eventually she started just making friends with everybody in the diner, and like, she was just so annoyed. He just wanted to like hang out with her,
brood.
Like, he just wanted to be with her. Yeah, it was like...
That's bizarre.
She said it was super bizarre.
Well, like, Scorsese plays the biggest creep in that movie. You know, he's the taxi, taxi customer that talks about like the worst shit imaginable. Yeah.
How many? Is that the only movie he appears in himself? Because he, you
I
know,
feel
he
like
puts
he's done
his,
that before.
He puts his first AD in all of his movies.
Oh, really?
I worked with his first AD on Revolutionary Road. And his first AD, oh, God, I wish I remember his
name. Oh, I forgot you were in that. That was great.
Thanks for that. in the movie, he, like in Casino, he plays the guy who, like, you know the two guys who are cheating?
Mm-hmm.
And then the one guy, he breaks his hand.
Yeah, he plays that guy?
No, he walks over to the other guy and he says, you can either take the money and we cut off your hand,
oh, right? Yeah, yeah.
Or you can just leave.
I know
he
that
goes,
guy.
He goes, I'd like
yeah.
to leave.
Yeah, oh, that's the guy. Oh, that's him? Oh, that's hilarious.
But he's just like him as an AD, like in that scene. It's uh-huh. like, he's like, guys, we got
to
go.
Yeah.
Guys, we
okay, I'd like to leave. Let's go.
Guys,
let's,
we got to shoot. Yeah. We got to shoot because we're losing light, guys. So.
Amazing. Oh, wow, that's funny.
Pesci in Casino, that's a performance
God
that
damn,
is
that performance
incredible.
Is so
good. Yeah.
But is... virtually the same.
I was gonna say.
Goodfellas.
I was gonna say.
But you don't care.
It's yeah. pretty much him.
So,
I would imagine. You know?
That, talking about those two performances are two of the funnest performances.
Yeah, that, yeah.
To watch.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I just had Ike Barinholtz in here, and Goodfellas was his pick.
Oh wow!
So we got to dig in deep.
Oh
on
yeah,
that
that's
one.
A,
that was good.
Wow, that's probably top five of mine. Definitely top 10. That movie.
Yeah. That, yeah. That movie's incredible. That movie's incredible.
Hey, can I pee?
Yes. here's a card that'll get you back in.
All right, talk about the movie now that I'm gone. I never seen it. I've never watched it.
My neighbor was actually in season one, Catherine Dyer.
Oh, of course, yeah.
She lives like three houses up from me.
Oh, that's funny. She's super nice.
Yeah, cool. She's great. And
Catherine played the woman who was like working with Brenner, who comes in.
Yeah, like one of the
child services.
The dark agent.
Kill 11.
Oh wow!
Yeah, yeah.
She had a good death.
She's yeah, she's great. She's great in it.
She's good.
She's super dark.
Yeah, she's not like that, and she's really sweet too.
Yeah,
she's mm-hmm. like really kind of bright and like kind of happy and stuff.
Yeah,
and yeah, she was really dark in that. That's
yeah.
a great reveal in the season. One is when she comes over for child services, and then they just shoot him in the head or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a great moment.
You
yeah.
guys like working in Atlanta?
Yeah, it's okay. I mean, I don't. It's not my home. So,
sure,
you know, it's yeah. like I miss my home, and
New
my
York,
life.
Right?
Yeah, I miss my life. But you know, the crews are amazing here, and the people are really nice. Everyone's really chill here. I find, like,
yeah.
I mean, I'm used to living in Manhattan, right? So it's like,
right?
In Manhattan, everybody's so ambitious.
Yeah.
So like.
Yeah.
Like the excellent, like even like you ask people, they're just like, you know, where do I get a piece of pizza? And they're like, well, the best pizza
mm-hmm.
is like everybody's got a thing. And like here in Atlanta, it's just like people just, it seems like people have days where they're just like, yeah, I don't care. Like whatever, we'll go to the dog park. And I'm like, yeah, that's awesome. We never do that in New York. We're always like running around trying
yeah.
to achieve.
Right. That's
but,
funny.
So I really like that about Atlanta, you know.
Brett, you live in LA?
Yeah.
What part?
Yeah. I live in West Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived in New York for 10 years. I dig Atlanta. Yeah, again, I mean, you know, while I'm not here as long as David, it's fun to work here, and it's cool that it's –
Have you
know,
shot other stuff down here, Brett?
Yeah. Yeah, I have shot other things. I don't remember exactly what. I mean, it's can I say that I'm – is this being recorded?
Yeah, but
what?
I can
say that I'm here shooting this? Is
of course.
That okay?
It's been revealed that you're in season three.
It has?
I think so.
I was going to say.
I've talked about it.
Okay.
If it's not out,
then
it's
again,
out.
I talk about all kinds of shit.
Yeah,
I talk about.
I guess
but
we
I,
should check.
No. It's been revealed that you're part of the world. And
is there anyone I need to check in with about anything?
No, I don't
think so. Maybe we should check that's been revealed, I guess, but I don't know. But you know.
It's
no?
Well, as long as
man,
you
you're so much more respectful.
As long as you don't say what you're
doing.
Like it's the same thing, like if, you know, Flo is Susan Larkin still in the show? John
right.
and the cops are still in the show?
Yeah.
Murray is a fixture in Hawkins, Indiana. He appears in season three.
John
right,
Reynolds,
I guess.
Man. Huh? Crazy connection with John Reynolds.
John is so good.
He is so good.
Yeah.
He's good friends with like all the music guys from Chicago that I lived with for a long time. And
really?
I didn't even know this connection, but yeah, he's I guess he lives in New York. He's he's a New York comedy dude, but he lived in Chicago for a long time. So funny, man. He is
that guy's so funny.
He's got
so funny. He's great on Search Party. Is a great show.
Search Party is a great show. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mostly have worked on this here, so I have such a great time working on this that I associate Atlanta with that. But I also, I mean, I love a lot of things. I went to school in the South.
Where'd you go?
I went to North Carolina School of the Arts.
Mm-hmm. No way, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh yeah,
that's a good school for
David Gordon Green and Paul Schneider. Were they same time period? Or?
Yeah, but they were in the film program. I was in drama.
Oh, okay.
So, but I knew them. I knew them.
Oh, cool.
I knew Jody and Danny. And David Gordon Green and Paul. I'm classically trained.
A lot of talent came out of that.
That's what
school.
I mean.
It's
and
crazy.
It's funny that it's like that's the other thing is that I do think that I do think comedic actors get discriminated.
Mm-hmm. I love that you have this. You really do have this like thing eating at you a little bit, where you feel
chip
like
on your shoulder.
You feel like we don't view you as
you.
Like, well, just the world. Like I think that you have a little bit of a thing where there's this insecurity where you feel like we don't give you the respect that we might give. Like we don't think that you could play Coriolanus. Like you're like you know, and you're a little bit annoyed by that because you've done some comedy that's like off the wall.
I think that you think I could play Coriolanus.
Right, right. But you
do, right?
I think you're a little long in the tooth, but some of the other roles, yes, perhaps. Yes.
I could play,
you know, you could play King John, for example.
I could
if
play
anyone's ever
Richard
read
the
that.
Third. Richard the Third.
Yeah, I'd like to see you. You'd be
I would
a
love
funny
to play Richard.
That actually
the third.
Would be a really.
But that part should be funny.
Yeah, no, I would make him. I mean, as a choice, I do think he should be funny. Because
he's
having
he's
a lot of fun.
But shouldn't everybody just, when like, I feel like that's such an important trait.
Was ever woman wooed? Was ever woman won? Right? Like that excitement?
I mean, yeah.
Fucking, oh, it's great.
Well, of course, I'm insecure about everything. So.
That's a trait. Yeah. That's a trait, though, that you can take out of stuff. You can always, like, take comedy out of stuff. But I think it's far harder to, like, have somebody who is maybe less experienced with comedy bring comedy
in.
That's
for
just
sure.
All we think.
I've always admired comedians, like, actor comedians. Like, again, and this is a guy who I know is a complicated guy, but that performance of Ricky Gervais in the original 6-episode Office.
Oh, man. So great.
Is not only a great comedic performance, it is a great acting performance.
Yeah.
There is so much psychology in that performance.
Yeah.
There is so much dense psychological work that, like, it is stunning. Like,
yeah.
That guy is a stunning actor.
Yeah.
Also, like Robin Williams in Good Will Hunting. I think about like him being like a super funny, also like.
Or Awakenings.
Like glowing with energy, and he just, you know, whoop. Just,
incredible. Yeah. He was incredible in Awakenings.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't. I think that the people that I work with, I don't have an insecurity about them thinking I'm taking me seriously. But of course, you know. Yeah. I mean, we all have – it's part of being an actor, I think, is always finding some reason of why people in the business don't take you seriously or are trying to box you in.
Yeah,
you know, so I'm very open about that. But,
right.
Maybe too open. I don't know. But I should drop that insecurity. You're totally right. Totally right. David teaches me a lot.
I didn't say that.
What?
I didn't say you should drop it. I just –
You're just pointing it out.
I just want to know it. I just want to know it. I think you should incorporate it. Again, in terms of vulnerability or in terms of things, like one of the interesting things in performance that I think is so interesting is I come up against things, you know, where things will happen in my life. Like I won't be able to – like I'm getting older, right? I'm not able to move exactly the way that I used to be able to move, or I'm not able to – things like that. And I always think about it initially in terms of acting. I'm always like, oh – this is going to cut off things that I could do or like da-da-da or like grace or elegance or whatever. And then I'm always like – when I take the mindset of incorporating it as a good thing, like always, and using that to expand. I mean there is a like – I think it's a Strasberg quote of there are no distractions, only potential for inspiration, right? So like even these things where you point out little things or foibles or insecurities or even things about my own narcissism or arrogance or whatever, like they're things to be incorporated and used.
Of course.
As opposed to things to be discarded and trying to like
– ashamed of or something like
that. Yeah, or even, you know –
And the funny thing is, like, even, like, whatever, in season one and continue, like, I had a big neurosis about, like, I wanted to get in shape for it, you know? And I was like, because all my friends who, like, have shirtless scenes in TV shows are always like...
shredded.
You know, yeah, they always are like, oh, shit, I gotta take my shirt off, like, I'm gonna get shredded. And I was like, no, let's, like, play the character. And, like, you know what's fun is, like, he can be a real human being, and then also he can be insecure about himself being overweight, like, as you're shooting. Like, you can incorporate all of it. Like, you don't have to just make it like, oh, I'm gonna show you that I don't care. You can actually care as well. But there's a feeling of incorporated, and then there's a feeling of, like, lying about it.
Yeah.
That I, yeah.
But I mean, that's
a very long tangent about, like, something like that quality in you. And I think it actually comes across in certain things you play. There's this quality
I put all of my insecurities into everything.
Exactly.
And it's always to be used. Even when you get over something personal, it's still there for you to use.
Yeah,
you're still
true.
Always connected to it. So, no, it should never be looked at as something that, like, you have to overcome for your art. But sometimes maybe in
personal life.
Just for me to be an easier person to talk
to. Yeah, that's true.
Joe, with music, though, the same is true for that.
Sure.
Like, I think it's just artists in general want to push themselves to do something different. Like, there's never been a band that wanted to put out the same record time after time.
Sure.
Or that's why the, you know, the guys go out and do solo records. It's because they want to try something different.
Sure, yeah.
It's like, what do you feel like musically? How does that relate?
Not wanting to, like, repeat yourself? Or
yeah,
put yourself in
just
a box,
wanting
caring
to do something really different. And
yeah, I think that's kind of, I guess, inherent in everything, you know? Inherent in acting, inherent in music. Yeah, just wanting to not put the same thing out twice. And it's probably just for your own self-enjoyment, too, because what's the fun of doing something twice, I guess?
Right.
But it's, I don't know. I think it's really difficult in music, especially in, like, the rock and roll genre.
Because
it's like, you know, we're getting to a point where, you know, early 70s, there was a lot of ground to be explored, you know, and there was a lot of new instruments being created and stuff. So there was really new ground to be explored. But in terms of, like, kind of rock and roll, right now it's really super derivative of, like, things that have already come out.
Right.
So I find that that's probably the biggest sort of block, is the fact that, you know, it is, I think, statistically maybe harder to put something else out that's different.
Totally.
But also that could just be me.
No, I think you're right.
Myself,
I mean, there aren't,
you know,
very many, in music, very many waves of, like, now if you start a band, people say, well, what do you guys like? And you're like, oh, well, those are the guys that do, like, the Stones thing.
Yeah,
or they're sort of
exactly,
like Sonic Youth.
Exactly.
Whereas
exactly.
I felt like they were the ones, like, forging those paths.
Yeah.
But then they were all being influenced by, you know, old blues and,
for sure.
It's all sort of a cycle.
I guess, like, maybe the distinction between, like, Chuck Berry and the Beatles, there's a way bigger difference to me in my mind with those two than there is, like, the Beatles and, like, Tame Impala or something like that.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? I feel like maybe it's traveling less, or maybe just one step less removed.
I like
maybe.
Tame Impala.
Me too.
Yeah,
I love
great.
Them. Huge influence for me. Amazing band.
Tame,
you know?
Impala?
Tame Impala.
Yeah.
Is that like
great
the
band.
Car Impala?
Could be. I don't know.
Okay.
I think they're Australian,
Aussie.
Right?
Yeah, it's a guy, and it's his own solo project. This guy, Kevin Parker, it's like, you know, does it all
it's
himself, writes it. And
are they like Sonic Youth?
No, it's like, it's like, you know, Pink Floyd,
yeah,
Beatles.
Yeah, there you go. Compare.
It's
compare,
its own.
Compare,
I think it's its own thing. I think, I think he manages to
do his own
thing and stand above, apart from the rest.
I think so.
I don't know if I would classify it as rock and roll, though. Hmm. But, I mean, maybe if he does, then it is. So, I don't know. You classify it as rock and roll?
I don't know. I guess maybe in its core, in its conception. But I don't know. It's also different album to album, I would say.
Right.
Like, the latest album was so much less than where it started off as, like, kind of this psych rock. And now it's almost like R&B bass and drums with guitar rock sort of built into it, but then also, like, pop hooks and, you know, psychedelic effects.
I'm not as knowledgeable about the band, I'm sure, as you are. I just started listening to that, actually.
I just geek out over that shit. Yeah, I love.
A lot of musical innovation happens in this. I mean, I'm a big hip-hop fan.
Oh, yeah?
That's
really
where the biggest...
Wow.
Because if you think about it, the conception of that was so recent that there's still – there's. I feel like it's able to grow a lot more.
And
there's
this city is the city that pushes it the most.
Well, yeah, and that's why everyone went nuts when the Super Bowl was here this year and they announced the act was Maroon 5.
Oh, yeah.
And everyone went berserk. They were like, you're in Atlanta terrible. And you're not bringing out, you know.
Yeah.
And then the Patriots.
Outcast and Usher.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What if
T.I.
They
had so many people to choose from, and
I know.
Yeah,
hey, it's pretty. Hey, I would have loved if they brought out Gucci and Future. And
Or like Migos or
Migos. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'm not up on current hip hop. I was really into it in college. So from like 87 to 97 ish, that was kind of my realm, and then I sort of dropped off, unfortunately.
Right. No, I love that realm too.
Oh yeah,
but I don't exclude the realm of today at all.
I should get back into it.
It's just different. It's just very different.
It is, yeah.
All right, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that. You know I did. I enjoy all these talks, but this one was very special. We had a lot of fun, and those guys were all three just very cool, down-to-earth, humble guys. It seems like they really have a good time working together. And have really made a family there here in Atlanta on the Stranger Things set with the crew and the cast. So it was really, really cool. Very, very nice to see. I hope you enjoyed that. We will come back next week with part two when we get into Big Night, which, trust me, you won't be let down with that conversation either. It's very, very good. And those guys all love that movie as much as I do. So I hope you dug this one. And we will be back next week with part two. And until then, beware the Demogorgon. Movie Crush is produced, engineered, edited, and soundtracked by Noel Brown and Ramsey Yunt at HowStuffWorks Studios, Ponce City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.